Welcome back to the Bible Magazine, and we are watching so much go on right now as far as Bible prophecy is concerned. We are in a changing world. We are watching incredible things take place on many fronts. We have with us again Pete Owen, and Pete is with us all the way from the UK to discuss some of these things. We look at the prophecies and we look at events going on, and we are sure that we are on the right track. Things are moving as expected. I am actually quite excited, actually, for much of what's going on, because it seems that you can go for a long time where things move a little slower, and all of a sudden you can have a moment like this that can be significant. Things can move faster than maybe they have in a long time, and you have a big moment of change. Pete, you're with us. How are things in the UK?
Well, I mean, like everywhere else in the world. Good to see you, John, and great to be with you. Thanks for having me again. But yeah, like everywhere else in the world, I mean, we're reeling at the moment. I mean, I'm told there are even islands that penguins live on that are currently reeling. Because of these, you know, tariffs that Trump's brought in, and I wouldn't have thought that there are many places in the world right now that where governments aren't scrambling and that individuals aren't worried and anxious and stressed. Companies are stressed. You know, my own niece's husband works for Jaguar Land Rover in the UK, and JLR. You know that. You know, that whole company is sort of really stressed about, you know, exports to the US, big car manufacturer in the UK. And, you know, if the tariffs which Trump has said are going to happen, then it really, in other words, I'm just sort of trying to illustrate, it really affects people's lives. You know, there are individuals that I know who are worried about their livelihood because of these tariffs. And that's the case across the world. And let's face it, Britain is getting off relatively lightly when compared to some other place in the world with these tariffs.
Yeah, thanks, Pete. That's it's true. And I must say, when we look at the effect on the nations, I know it's going to affect Britain, although there's something there, and I'm going to mention it now because otherwise I'll forget. The way the tariff is, it actually underlines for Britain the benefit of being out of Europe. So we expected Brexit to happen prophetically. It was in the Bible magazine for many years that, and other writers as well, that Britain would come out of Europe. But when we then come and look at the tariff today, I mean, you're there, so you're probably no better than I. They're like, you guys are getting maybe a 10% or something, but Europe's That's getting right. a 30%. So the interesting thing is that actually for the people of Britain, it makes it the case that independence is superior and sort of underlines that. Now, as much as we would expect Brexit or did expect Brexit to happen, and it happened, for me, that was a huge moment. I was raised on the fact that Britain would come out. When that happened, it was enormous. But as much as we would expect Brexit to happen, or did expect it, we would then expect America to separate from Europe. That relationship is not just that. It's not just that Britain has to be independent. No. Britain has to be. There's going to be an antagonism there. They are not friends. So when we then come to America, understanding that America is one of the from Ezekiel 38, the young lions. One of the national offspring of Britain, we then go, okay, so then the relationship that the breakdown in relationship that's there between Britain and Europe, as much as Keir Starmer wants to try and patch things up, that's going to be an uphill battle. But as much as we'd expect that, we'd expect America to fall out with it as well. And then from there, also, frankly, Canada, Australia, all those. These are on one side. These will oppose the Northern Alliance of Nations. So when we then, so when I say, you know, things are happening, which we've expected for a long time, it is the breakdown of the world order established after World War II, with the Marshall Plan and the whole, you know, that entire, and by the way, this is, you know, like, that world order that existed actually did bring peace to the world.
Yeah.
It did. It actually brought peace to the world. And
well, certainly stability.
Peace, yeah, in a way, you know, I mean, we've had 80 years of essentially peace. I know there's been some things in the Balkans, but overall, Europe's been peaceful. That is something that I think we will see start to change. The plan that Europe has to rearm is right in line, and maybe you want to, I don't know if you want to speak to this, but I would see it, Pete, as the, in the words, and I think I've said this before on one of these, but in the words of Revelation 16, we have the beast, the dragon, and the false prophet, and the beast has to rise. So everything we're seeing right now is watching this, the separation of these, you know, the antagonism is starting to develop, and there's many quotes we could use, or Ursula, the head of the
von
EU, von der Leyen, she has come out and said, you know, this is it, things have to change. Germany is saying the same thing, things have to change. Even Macron has been saying the same thing. They all realize you can't trust America, especially when it can swing like this. And one of the greatest agitators to this is J.D. Vance, which is interesting because J.D. Vance, along with others, including, by the way, Elon Musk, would say that Europe needs to essentially get its act together and needs to stand for its own, you know, for its own defense,
it's possibly this week, John, that Trump said, didn't he, that, you know, he says, you know, do you realize the only reason that the European Union was even founded? It was founded in opposition to America, right?
Yeah, yeah, he
said
that before.
It was founded to take on America economically.
Yep.
So, yeah, he's sort of not holding back. And I think it is important that we see, I mean, you mentioned the difference in tariffs. I think the tariffs for Europe are 20% at the moment, and for Britain, 10%. I think it's that. And I think that is important, that you've got that difference, that Britain Trump is alluring Britain to say, you know, stick with us, you're economically better with us.
That's right.
And I think it's also important because, you know, occasionally, you know, someone will sort of say, you know, hey, you know, how, you know, you talk about Britain, America being one of the offshoots of Britain and, you know, one of the sort of children of Britain, as it were. You know, you're going back a long time, you're going back to the 1700s and sort of Britain, you know, America rejected British rule, and that's the whole point of American independence, the rest of it. And American, the government system is sort of aligned with France. But just look at what you're seeing, I would say, in that, you know, America doesn't say to France, listen, you can have 10% tariffs. Actually, it's right. Britain and America and Canada and Australia. And I think that what we will see in the coming weeks and months is that the allies of the southern power of Ezekiel 38 will, after this sort of massive shakeup that Trump has brought about economically, and you know, let's be clear, this is enormous. This is sort of, it really has changed the world order, given an absolute shakeup. But the sort of allies that will come together, I think the angels are working to bring about the likes of America and Britain. And at the moment, the Canadians are deeply wounded by you know, Trump and that government's treatment of Canada. But I suspect in due time that they'll also, you know, come together, and the likes of Australia and those sort of traditional Commonwealth nations, add into that the Gulf nations. And we talk about this, don't we? Because this is Ezekiel 38, you know, Ezekiel 38:13, puts on one side, and it's not a question of, well, these are the goodies and these are the baddies. It's not that at all. You know, you've got one group of nations that are together. Now, there is none good, as it were, but that said, that group of nations are naturally more sympathetic towards Israel.
Yes.
And so I think that their economic conditions will change, because the sort of ancient prophecies say that those who bless Israel become blessed. And I suspect that although many economists will look on at what's happening and go, everything's about to collapse, and let's face it, that may well happen. It may well be that before things get any better, they'll get worse. But perhaps that these nations will be able to continue to sort of lend support to Israel, and the nations that at the moment, the likes of Britain, who frankly, you know, with the current government, you know, don't say a huge amount encouragingly towards Israel, you know, I think that at some stage that may change, and I suspect that it's Trump's leadership that's going to bring about some of that change.
This is, so just for the record, right now, there was two, I can't remember their names, left-wing politicians under the Labour government that were critical
who
of
flew Israel. Into Israel.
Yeah, they flew into Israel, and Israel went, yeah, actually, frankly, you can go back. It was certainly the Labour government is seeing it as a big slap. David Lammy, who is not a supporter of Israel, has taken this at great offense. So right now, Israel and Britain are at odds because of the Labour government's stance. I mean, previously, the Labour government had Jeremy Corbyn, who was about as anti-Israel as you could come. I think it was probably the most anti-Israel prime minister England's had in a long time. There will be change, but I would, you know, the interesting thing is, and you brought up, you know, and I think we brought this up before, but you can't not mention it. I'll bless those that bless you, curse those that curse you. That is, that's like the foundation for how, if a nation is supporting Israel and et cetera, things are going well. And certainly that's specifically relevant for nations that have been influenced by the Bible. If a nation's had the Bible, then the national responsibility is higher. I think that is a principle also that is always worth noting. The quote unquote English speaking world, which in prophetic terms is the Isles, and that's, you know, we could go into that, but those nations have a higher level of responsibility because of that, and frankly, that includes Europe as well. So in the end, it won't go well for Europe, but if we look at the prophecies, it's kind of like Haman, where he's allowed to get himself right up and doing seemingly well before the downfall. Okay, so that's kind of, and I agree on the economy. The way I look at it is so many economists are coming out against what Trump's doing, and I think, you know, us mere mortals, you're lucky if the economists can predict tomorrow. So, you know, that's kind of the way I feel. At the same time, I think if Trump has any chance, it just might be because at the same time you're supporting Israel.
So, yeah, that's right. What I would say, though, is that, at some stage, some of these nations may well do, you know, okay economically. But one way or the other, you know, I think that the return of the Lord is pretty, you know, seriously close. And that actually, that wealth, if any is, you know, had, I don't suppose many individuals will see it and benefit from it. You know, in the end, it will be, you know, for others. So as in, you know, the sort of the Jewish commonwealth that will build from Jerusalem when the Lord Jesus Christ returns, and the resources that will be required for the kingdom to be established. I certainly don't think that, you know, we need to sort of be anxious in a way that is making our hearts fail for fear, because I think that what we're seeing is that in through these policies, a time of the feet, as it were, and by that, John, you'll know what I mean. You know, when we sort of say the time of the feet, we're, our minds go straight to Nebuchadnezzar's image in Daniel chapter 2. And, you know, we understand that that image shows us world history. And at the time of the end, when the stone power hits the image, you've got iron and clay that can't mix, that the nations are fragmented. And so I think through these economic policies, we're seeing the world order change. You know, you're seeing economists and governments that are saying that for so long we've had free trade, we've had, you know, open borders, we've had this idea that nation states just trade freely with one another, and that there's, you know, if you want to buy anything from here, you buy it from here, you buy it from there, it's all open, there's nothing to worry about. Well, the sort of feet of the image seem to suggest to me a time when the nations aren't freely trading in that sort of way, but they're fragmented. That nations states are looking after themselves. They're you know, on their own. You know, you could, you know, reference the beast power at the time of the end with the 10 horns and 10 nations, and you got 10 separate nations, as it were. You know, and I appreciate that would, you know, be referring particularly to Europe. But do you see this idea that actually the nations are fighting for themselves and for their own national identity and their own national might, as opposed to having this sort of comfortable, we're all in this together? Now, having said all that, we do know that in Europe, that the beast territory, the 10 horns that are, you know, have been wrangling and fighting for themselves, at some stage are going to say, right, the only way we're going to manage is if we come together in a really tight-knit unit and give their power and their strength to the beast. But that's for a period, we believe, in Revelation 17, we're told it's for 1 hour, which we understand prophetically to be a period of 30 years. And we think that that is actually post the return of the Lord Jesus Christ. So in other words, before the Lord comes, there's a fragmentation of the nations. But when the Lord comes, that the European nations will turn around and say, we've got to get together. And of course, they need a rider. And it's the harlot system of Rome, the harlot woman, the apostate church, that says, you know, we'll ride the beast, we'll provide the leadership to the beast of Europe. And so we'd expect that the Roman Catholic Church, the Pope, to sort of take that leadership role in Europe to bring the nations together in order that they might fight against who they would see as Antichrist, but of course will be the Lord Jesus Christ in Jerusalem. So I just think that's important that we see from the feet in Nebuchadnezzar's image in Daniel chapter 2, a time when the stone hits, when it isn't all, it's not iron, you know, it's not gold, it's not silver, it's not brass, it's not iron, it's iron and clay, and they're not mixing. The fragmentation of the nations when the stone hits.
Yeah, I understand, Pete, and I think it's interesting that it's the iron and the clay, and, you know, maybe this isn't, we're not always getting deep into it, but if you follow clay through Scripture, it is, we are clay, it's the people are clay. And so you've got democratic government, the government is in the hands of the people, mixed with iron, which is authoritarian, is Roman. Super interesting, because they don't mix well, and yet here they are sort of together. And that is, if we understand that the image is the kingdoms of men, which specifically is in the European arena at the time of the end, or the, I guess we could say in this case, the Russian-European arena, that northern area, that is the kingdom of men. And they're going to come together. Whether they like it or not, those nations are kind of jammed together. It might not be a great fit, but here they are, we find them together. And actually, what we would expect is for, you know, going back to 1800s, John Thomas writes the book Anatolia, Russia triumphant, Europe chained. And I think that that still holds true. And part of that coming from Ezekiel 38, again, a guard like over them. Like it's like Russia is there essentially staking its claim.
John, I think it's such an important point because, you know, for a long time, it's just seemed ludicrous to most political commentators and even many Bible students, the idea that Russia, you know, and Europe can somehow be on the same. I mean, right now, you know, they are opposed to each other. You know, there's no doubt about it. You know, the European Union is furious about what Russia is doing. You know, it's one of the drivers for them, particularly without America's support, in wanting to discuss having a collective European army and the like. But it doesn't seem to me and to many to be so ludicrous anymore, because Europe is quite clearly being separated, as you spoke about earlier, from, well, we've seen it from the Tarshish power in terms of Brexit, and now Trump is accelerating that process, that prophetic process that we've expected to happen, moving the likes of America away from Europe through their policies. And Europe, at some stage, the democracies of Europe will vote again. And at the moment, they've got leaders who say, you know, we'll do this, that, and the other for you. But most of those leaders will come and go, while the likes of Vladimir Putin in Russia will stay, because he doesn't do democracy in the same way that Europe does democracy.
Democracy as in, you know, if you oppose me, you just might be, you know, you just might be drinking the wrong cup of tea.
That's right. Yeah. So the European leaders will change guard. You know, there'll be a change in the guard there. There'll be another one in, another one in, another one in. And you can see that some of those political parties in the next few years will simply say, listen, we can't trust America anymore. If you vote for us, what we will do is we will make friends with Russia. We'll sort of end this. We'll get you cheaper gas prices, cheaper energy prices. You know, we'll sort of team up again. We'll be friends again. And at the moment, that's so unpalatable. And people, oh, no, we'd never do that. Well, if actually, you know, you've got massive tariffs by exporting to America that is hitting your business and it's starting to affect individuals in these countries, in the end, it's money that talks, isn't it? And actually, the individual will go, do you know what? Yeah, I think we'll vote for this party because they're going to make me better off. And actually, why would we bother siding with the likes of America and go? They don't care about us. You can imagine that many in Europe will be jealous of the likes of Britain for having only 10% when they've been clobbered with 20%.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I just think it's something that not that long ago for many seems like just a ludicrous idea, that we would speak, that the prophetic word suggests, or doesn't suggest, it tells us that Russia at the time of the end will actually be confederate with European nations. Now, it might not be, you know, a comfortable fit. It may be that they're not particularly wanting to be in bed together, as it were. But one of the reasons we so confidently say this is, well, let me give a couple of, you know, clear reasons. One is Ezekiel 38, where the first group of nations from sort of verse 1 to 6 or so, they are Gog, the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshach and Tubal. Russia is confederate with Iran, Persia, but Iran today, Libya, Ethiopia, those sort of North African countries, and Iran. Russia and Iran isn't vaguely difficult to understand at the moment, nor particularly Libya and Ethiopia. We see Russia having significant influence in those countries. So that's all easy. The one then that you know, people, what? You know, Goma, which we understand to be sort of France, you know, Germany, that sort of Northern European ancient territory. That's the one that, well, you know, France is never going to be, you know, Germany can't, look at their policies at the moment towards Russia. But I just I think stick with it. You know, that at some stage that will change. And for whatever reason, those nations will connect in with Russia. And of course, the other reason that we're so confident about it is because, going back to Nebuchadnezzar's image, there are two legs to the image, and the legs represent Eastern and Western Rome. And yeah, Western Rome fell in 476, Eastern Rome fell in 1453, and we come to the time of the feet of part iron and part clay. But there are still two sides. You've got Eastern, and there are still two feet, as it were. And we're told in Daniel chapter 2 that when the stone hits the image, I'll just read the verse now. I've just opened it. So Daniel 2, verse 34. Thou sawest till that a stone was cut out without hands. We know that that's the Lord Jesus Christ when he returns to the earth, which smote the image upon his feet that were of iron and clay and break them in pieces. So when the stone hits the image, it doesn't hit an image that's stood on one leg, that's all Europe or all Russia. It doesn't hit an image that's, you know, that's already half broken down. The image is standing on its feet. Now, to stand, you know, it's both feet, right? So in other words, East and West, Europe, Western Europe, East Russia, the two sides of the great Russia, the great Roman Empire, at the time of the end, will stand up. We're told that they're going to come down into Israel. We're told that in Ezekiel 38. And yeah, that's when the stone power is going to hit. So I think that these policies that we're seeing at the moment coming out of America are crucial in breaking up the world order in order to drive Europe towards Russia, that the image power might be prepared.
Okay, a little bit to unpack. I think it's helpful. You mentioned that Russia is the eastern leg. I think we can do this very quickly. You think, how on earth? The Roman Empire was never in Russia. Well, that's not the way the Russians see it. So, you know, and there's actually a famous, I think it's a National Geographic image that says the three Romes. So what we have is you have obviously Rome, then you have Constantinople is the east, but that Byzantine side, the eastern side, essentially there's a marriage between Ivan and Sophie or something back in the day, and Russia says we actually want to take on that title. So they try to claim the successor to be the successors of the Roman Empire in that way, and that was historically a move that they did. But when they did that prophetically, it's really important because then you can see it's not just, you know, we've come up with this idea that Russia could be. No. They themselves tried to actually develop this, prove it, claim it, however you want to say. And by the way, when they did that, it was with the approval of the Roman Catholic Church at the time. So the Roman Catholic Church blessed the marriage. It was Ivan and Sophie, I think, was the granddaughter of the last Byzantine emperor. So there
The
was this.
Roman Catholic Church needed it, John.
Yeah, they
They
did.
needed it
Yeah.
because the Byzantine Empire wasn't didn't just, as it were, in 1453, when Constantinople fell, it didn't fall to, you know, another Christian group. It fell to the Ottoman Turk. It fell
That's right.
to the Muslims who sort of come up from Saudi, the Ottoman Empire, which was suddenly expanding, you know, at an enormous rate, as Islam spread from the east to the west. And it was the Ottoman Turk, the religion of Islam, it's the Muslims that defeated Constantinople in 1453. Now, Western Rome,
Which is
well,
the
that's
story in the
fallen.
which is the story of the trumpets, if we were gonna, you know,
That's right,
we
that's
won't
right,
deep
that's
it,
right.
but it's epic. It's epic in the trumpets.
But why it's so significant is because Western Rome itself had fallen. Rome itself had fallen to the barbarian nations from the north, the sort of the ten horns, as it were, that had broken up the Roman Empire in the west 1,000 years previously. at the end of the 400s. But what then happened? Rome lived on for 1,000 years through the Byzantine Empire. But when the Ottoman Turk broke it up, suddenly Rome is like, where do we live? Where do we have our capital? Where do we, you know, where do people come to? What do we stand for any longer? And so no wonder the Roman Catholic Church blessed the idea that the notion of Rome would live on. And as you rightly say, the Moscow became the third Rome. In fact, you can today, but I don't know if you can do it today because, in fact, it's been changed to a mosque. But the Hagia Sophia, which
it's been changed to a mosque to the great irritation of
You know, Erdogan has changed to being a mosque. But when it was a museum, you could go there, and you may be able to now, I don't know. But you could see a picture on the Hagia Sophia, a beautiful mosaic. And on the mosaic, you had a star in Rome, you had a star in Constantinople, and you had a star in Moscow, the third Rome.
I'm going to tell you something. I didn't know that. That is epic. They have a mosaic there with the three stars on it.
Yeah. It's a great piece of sort of archaeological art that shows you that Constantinople, Rome, they're the sort of two ancient capitals of what was Rome. And then that when the notion of Rome sort of started collapsing when the Muslims came in, Moscow became the third Rome. So in other words, this isn't something that we look back on to go, oh, how can we fit Russia into this prophetic picture? Maybe we can say that Russia's the sort of eastern side. They are the eastern leg of the Roman Empire. They are the dragon power that would drop down actually into Constantinople before dropping down into Israel.
Yep. So I love it, and I knew, and I was aware of the history. I just didn't realize they had actually memorialized that in a plaque, which is, you know, I say for Bible prophecy, I shouldn't use the word nerds.
No,
because we should all really love these things. I think God has shared these things with us. What a blessing! But that's there is that's good. I like that. I don't just like it. I love that. Okay. Just real quick too, because if you ask me to prove that Russia was the northern invader, the power at the end, I would go first. I would go to Ezekiel 38, and that word Rosh is actually still. If you look at that word up in the Greek Septuagint, because we would say what's Rosh today, I think it's been translated in the King James as the chief prince, but the word chief is the word Rosh. We'd say, well, what is that today? That's not a nation we know. Like we would still be, you know, comfortable with Ethiopia, Libya, Persia. But that word is, if we go and look at it in the Greek Septuagint, that is still a word that to the Greeks means something, and it is the Rus peoples. If you just copy and paste the Greek word into Google, I've done this before. If you just copy that Greek word out of the Septuagint, copy it into Google, it comes up with Kievian Rus. So
yeah, that's right.
You know, so that's it's
which, by the way, John, I appreciate this is probably a topic for another night, but that's why it's so significant that Russia is in Ukraine,
because
and Putin doesn't hide it.
No, nope.
He openly says we are the ancient people that are together. You know, we are the Rus. We are, you know, the Belarusians, the Kievan Rus, the Russians. We're one people, and you know, we should never have been separated. And so he uses that sort of historical rhetoric to say why it is that Russia right now sits in what most people consider to be Ukraine.
Yeah, agreed. So that's interesting. I'm going to say one thing on Europe, and that is it. When you say it could, it sounds like it might be. It sounds maybe far-fetched to imagine that Europe would be a little less resistant to Russia. I would say a couple of things. Number one, it's not that far-fetched, Pete, anymore. I would just say, by the way, it's not really anymore. Because if you look, what's happened to Marine Le Pen over the last, I don't know, week or two?
Yeah.
They're trying to imprison her. And what's Marine Le Pen's view of Russia? It just isn't as hostile as the Macrons of the world. So already the politicians that are rising and Europe themselves are actually trying to suppress. The same thing's happening in Germany. The politicians, the right-wing politicians that are coming up that Europe are trying to suppress actually are more amicable to Russia. I would say that.
Agreed.
The other one I would say, which we don't really have time to dive too much, is but if you track the moves of the Vatican over the period of especially just this Ukraine war, the Vatican is not hostile to Russia. They are much more amicable with them as well. They are welcoming to them. They position themselves as if they're going to be kind of a go-between, which when we go back to the time of Europe and Russia, when they came together briefly under Justinian, it was also at the the Pope was there at that time stirring the pot, because this isn't the first time we've seen East and West. It never came together in its fullness, but it sort of did for a little bit there under Justinian. We'd say that was the best the Roman Empire could do after it, you know, fell to the barbarians, was under Justinian, and the Pope was there. He was there bringing this together. I don't think the Vatican in any way. I used to work at a printing company for many years, and we used to print prayer cards. We did once print prayer cards for. I think it was the Knights of Columbus. But in there, it was the prayer for that. Christmas was praying for peace with Russia and that it would come together. It's the whole story of Fatima and all this. Russia and Europe coming together is not a hidden agenda of the Vatican.
Yeah.
It is entrenched. So I would say that as well.
That's super interesting. And we've seen, haven't we, you know, just to add to that, John, on a purely religious level, I mean, nothing is purely religious level when the Vatican's, you know, involved. But we've seen religiously the Orthodox Russian Church, the Orthodox Greek Church, which is the sort of the Orthodox Catholic Church, as it were, the Roman Church rather of the East, getting together to speak with the likes of Kirill. Have got together to speak with the Pope, yep, in order that there might be that alliance. So you know, I've sort of, you know, tried to sort of suggest that it's not unreasonable on a political and economic level. You're pointing out that, listen, historically there's good reason for this, and we certainly shouldn't be surprised by it. And you're pointing out the fact that religiously the likes of the popes have encouraged that. Through history, not least in recent years.
And I cannot mention it. When we talk about the church, the Catholic Church, the Roman Catholic Church being political, question mark, are you kidding me? That is the most political religious system, yeah, that there ever has been nor ever will be, essentially. Why? Because it's really good to remember this when we talk about the system of the beast, is that actually she was part, the Vatican was part of the beast, if you go back in Revelation, because she had her own territories. I mean, the we can't even imagine this today. The priest could show up at your door and have you imprisoned, because they, yeah, were, you know, we just went to the Vatican last year. They still have their own, they have their own army. They hire out the Swiss Guard, right? It might only be essentially somewhat of a show right now, but at the same time, they are their own country. They have their own guard today. And this is something that extremely bothered the Vatican when they lost it, 1870-ish or so, the temporal power of the Pope,
yeah,
when he lost it. So there's so much there. So they are inherently, they are a political system. And in fact, Russia claims to be the successor to the Roman Church. So does the successor to the Roman Empire, Russia claims. But the Vatican claims the same for themselves, that they are also the successor to the Roman Empire in the West. So there's, you know, these, when you look at Europe, and I don't think we have the time right now, we're going to run out of time. It is inherently, yes, it's a political project. It is also a Christian project as well. That the Roman Church would turn around and make the founders of Europe into saints as they have done is them putting a Christian crown on essentially those leaders. It's a political program. It is also a religious program, and there's much more we could say there. But that they would be political, like they are political. I mean, it's the only what other church is surrounded by embassies? You know, when you go up to the Vatican, you're passing embassy after embassy after embassy. All the world wants to nations of the world want to be at the Vatican and get their support for whatever they're doing. And I got to put one other thing there. When you go there, when you do this, you can't always have the exact date in front of you. It took a long time for the Vatican to recognize, they don't ever want to recognize, but, you know, politically they had to recognize the state of Israel. It took them, you know, it was Israel's born in 1948. It takes them decades before they recognize the state of Israel. Palestine, they talk about it like it's a nation. It's not even yet a nation, and they already have an embassy, and the Vatican already recognizes them. So there's, you know, they are as political as they come on all these things. Okay, so the one last thing, I mentioned this, but I want to underline this, and this will be in the upcoming Bible magazine. I'm sure it'll be mentioned as well. The strongest voices right now in America, if we just tie these together, in America, for Europe to stand on its own, essentially going, come on, Europe, what are you going to do? J.D. Vance.
Yeah.
Listen, I'm not somebody who's a conspiracy theorist. At the same time, I'm going, I can't help but notice you are a Roman Catholic. No true Roman Catholic wants to see the church without its power, without its temporal power, without essentially its political power. And where's the church going to have political power, would we expect? First and foremost, over Europe and in Europe. So, you know, I'm always a little bit going, it's interesting because for those that don't follow the church, they're really divided, and you really see the division in America. A side that would be more like Pope Francis, the liberal side, take away borders, you know, all that sort of thing. Very pro-immigration, all these things. And then you have the right side, the conservative side, and they are extremely conservative, certainly on immigration, certainly on borders, and would also want to see Europe truly rise up again. So I don't know exactly where I haven't, you know, this, you know, get the Bible magazine, you know, get the upcoming Bible magazine. It'll be in there. Yeah. It'll be in there. So these things are not insignificant. All these moves. There's so much there to unpack. But needless to say, that America is alienating Europe is 100% an enormous check mark. I would not wildly behind Brexit, as we said. So the only other thing I'd just throw in there to just make sure we say is that, by the way, as much as we expected Brexit, we also expect NATO to certainly falter, change. Whether it be a full breakup or a realignment, you can't have all these nations as a treaty organization. So just to make sure I think that's important. Essentially, as I see it, it would be almost as important as expecting Brexit.
Yeah, no, I quite agree that the North Atlantic Treaty Organization is not going to be there at the time of the end.
Isn't going to be there. So where we are in the prophetic timeline ourselves, that's another question. But that it will fall apart is as sure as Brexit. Okay, so
I think the other thing, John, just to chuck in that once again, what's America doing militarily at the moment? It's there in the south dealing with the Houthis, and I just think you just can't get away from it that this Iranian proxy group. Iran and Russia is equal 38 are on the same team, that one of the Iranian proxy groups, the Houthis, are doing what they're doing in Yemen, and who's there, a couple of massive, massive naval vessels at huge cost to the American taxpayer is there in the Red Sea dealing with it. And that's what we expect to see at the time of the end, that you've got two groups of nations, Ezekiel 38, Daniel 11. Daniel 11 describes them as the king of the north, Gog, land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, with them Libya, Ethiopia, Iran, Goma, we've spoken about Europe. On the other side, you've got Tarshish, the young lions, the Gulf states, and where's America? Well, America right now, and America's Navy is sitting there. And I just think, you know, we shouldn't be, you know, that something like that, that at the moment hardly gets a headline. It is of significance biblically on the prophetic scene. And I think that we should sit up, take note of these things. And although, you know, we're confident that the angels are doing their thing to work out God's plan and purpose, you know, amongst these sort of massive, massive nations, that in the eyes of God, they're nothing. That they're, it, you know, he could just move them in this direction, in that direction, in that direction. And although we might feel a bit worried ourselves and thinking, you know what, you know what, you know, I hope that things work out okay for me, for my family, for the people that I know, my neighbors and those in my, you know, church or ecclesia, that actually we just got to hang in there and know that God's working out his plan and purpose, and that if we stay faithful to this word, then we're going to be there when the world order changes and becomes the most incredible time of peace for us and for all those who are prepared to put their faith and trust into this word.
Yeah, thanks, Pete. I agreed. With the Houthis, let's be honest, a different America showed up. You know, You watched Biden and you know, Obama gave red lines to Syria, which were broken and not much happened. Biden said he was going to move in there and this was it. They were going to, you know, start this operation Guardian of Protection Guardian of Prosperity. And they did some stuff, but it really didn't amount to a lot. They didn't stop it, that's for sure. The America that's on the world stage today, wow, what a difference. You know, not only are they alienating the nations of the world, but good gracious, could, you know, Israel, as I think I've said before, Israel is pinching itself. I mean, that was one of the fronts. They talk in Israel about a seven-front war. The Houthis were one of those fronts. And they actually, because they were so propped up by Iran, they had a lot of technology. Their missile technology was significant, and they had stopped a majority of world shipping from going through the Suez. But for Israel, see, this is really important as well, because one of the characteristics of Tarshish and the young lions is, if we, you know, is this protectorate power. It is something that the scriptures talk about, you know, the land with shadowing wings. We see that in Isaiah, we see that this is in Britain. Britain was there protecting the Jewish state early on. As we come down to our age, it's not so much Britain today, but it's one of her offspring. And her offspring is acting in the same way, protecting Israel. And in fact, I'm going to play you a clip about Trump here in a moment, just to get your reaction, and we can discuss it. But on the front of Turkey, because Turkey's been trying to move into Syria, Trump again says on the Turkey file, he says to Netanyahu, he leaned over to him yesterday in front of the press and said, "If you have any issues with Turkey," he said, "well, I'll talk to them. We'll deal with it, and I think we can work this out." So it's exactly what it is. Many in Israel would like it if they didn't have to rely on the United States. The reality is that the protectorate power of Tarshish and the young lions, whether it's Britain for a while, whether it's America for a while, for a while there, Stephen Harper in Canada was a huge supporter of Israel. So there's always, within the family of nations, there's always been a supporter of Israel that it seems that God has used. So that's that. Let's just play this clip. I'm just going to, you know, just to give it a little context. This is in the meeting that Trump has with Netanyahu yesterday. And this is just discussing Gaza. So it's just a quick clip to give it the context.
We spoke about not only the hostages, but about Gaza. We're committed to getting all the hostages out, but also eliminating the evil tyranny of Hamas in Gaza, and enabling the people of Gaza to freely make a choice to go wherever they want. I mean, they should have that choice. And the president put forward a vision, a bold vision, which we discussed as well, including the countries that might be amenable and are amenable to accepting Palestinians of their free choice if they choose to go there. And I think that's the second thing that we discussed. But the hostages came right on top.
You know, do you think blocking humanitarian aid is also an effective pressure tactic?
Well, you know how I feel about the Gaza Strip. I think it's an incredible piece of important real estate. The level of death on the Gaza Strip is just incredible. And I've said it. I don't understand why Israel ever gave it up. Israel owned it. It wasn't this man, so I can say it. He wouldn't have given it up. I know him very well. There's no way. They took oceanfront property and they gave it to people for peace. How did that work out? Not good. They gave it away for a good intention and it didn't work out that way. And
I think what the president talked about is, first of all, to give people a choice. You know, Gazans were closed in. And every other place, including in arenas of battle, I mean, whether it's Ukraine or Syria or any other place, people could leave. Gaza was the only place where they locked them in. We didn't lock them in. They're locked in. And what is wrong with giving people a choice? Now, we've been talking, including over lunch, about some countries, I won't go into them right now, that are saying, you know, if Gazans want to leave, we want to take them in. And I think this is the right thing to do. If you give, you know, it's going to take years to rebuild Gaza. In the meantime, people can have an option. The president has a vision. Countries are responding to that vision. We're working on it. I hope we'll have good news.
So what an incredible piece that is, Pete. And I'm just going to say one thing right out of the top. This is really important. This idea that Trump is the one saying, why did you give up Gaza? Why did you give up Gaza? Because that's the paradigm that Israel's always been, essentially, until Trump and the Abraham Accords, but was always locked into, was land for peace. By the way, this is how everybody that pushes two-state solution, this is ultimately what they're saying is, you give up the Judea-Samaria, the quote-unquote West Bank, you give that up and you're going to get peace. Trump is saying, why did you give up Gaza? How did that work for you? The elephant in the room is, therefore, why would you, and we've discussed this before, because remember when he had the pen, right? He says, you know, Israel's, you know, I, you know.
That's right. Yeah,
right?
On
yeah.
The desk.
So he's already been saying that they're in a tough spot. But what that then is, how could Trump ever now turn around and say, you should give up the West Bank? I think this is really important. And by the way, it's what we would expect also from the prophecies, because the one place that the prophecies focus Jews on is in the Judea Samaria, the mountains of Israel, not on the coastline. Even though that it's good that they're on the coastline, but they have to be in the mountains of Israel.
But John, what makes it so extraordinary, I think, is that the world at the moment, let's face it, is furious with Trump. You know, every government, you know, they all have to pander to him because the American dollar is so wealthy. Interestingly, you know, John Thomas, you know, writing in the late 1800s, when asked about America's position on the world stage, said they're going to have to learn that there's one almightier than the dollar. He wrote in Eureka. But while the world at the moment, you've got governments kowtowing to America because of the dollar. But internally, in internal governments are furious, absolutely furious. Some of them more openly than others. I mean, Carney's not holding back much, is he, in Canada? But many, many governments, well, every government across the world is reeling. And that, you know, the likes of Starmer in Britain sort of having to brave face on and say, it's going to be okay. But internally, there's wrangling and political turmoil and challenge. Now, why does that matter? Because it's not beyond the realms of possibility at all, is it, that as nations lose faith in America and don't want to be connected to America, so Trump's vision for Israel, which Netanyahu, of course, is so delighted with, and so, you know, we've seen him promoting just yesterday from the Oval Office, that vision, which involves basically saying to those in Gaza, listen, why don't you guys, go somewhere else? And those in the West Bank, listen, why don't you head somewhere else? They've got the superpower of the world behind them saying, I don't know why you ever gave it up to them. What a dumb thing to have given it up. You never needed to give that up. The best real estate in Gaza. Why would you do it? And as you say, he's already said, Israel's just this tiny little nation. Think of the Middle East as my desk and the Oval Office. And if you hire up this pen lid, well, this is just Israel. Well, you can see that as nations lose faith in Trump and America and their trust in America, so the Battle of Armageddon is going to be fought when the frog-like spirits, the spirits of the humanism, draw the dragon, the beast, the false prophet, down into Israel, Ezekiel 38, onto the mountains. So it doesn't seem that far off to me.
No, I agree. I agree, Pete. 100%. Two other things that came out of that meeting, which we'll just throw out there because it is hugely significant. The first is, and this goes back to the protectorate power, is Iran. Here's Israel saying, what are we doing with Iran? And Trump is saying, listen, they're going to have he's offering a deal. He's going to talk directly to them. But we all know he's lined up the bombers in the Middle East. And so that on that side of things, look out. Good gracious. We're on the edge of war with Iran if Iran doesn't change. And we expect peace in the Middle East, and you're not going to get peace in the Middle East unless Iran is at least curtailed. And so that is highly significant as well. The last thing, too, is just simply the incredible thing that's happening, which is not hitting any of the news headlines, and that is that Israel is actually taking this opportunity to build around Jerusalem and in the West Bank. There are huge building projects going on, and they are trying to solidify their territories
presence
and ensure that there is no opportunity for a Palestinian state, because look what happened when they gave up land. So whatever went on in the conversations, Trump is getting the memo that land for peace does not work, and this is huge. So Pete, there's many things, and we're gonna.
John, I just should just jump in to say,
I was trying to be quick.
I'll be fast, but that is what we expect. Ezekiel 36 tells us that on the mountains, on the West Bank, that's exactly what's going to happen. That they will build, even all the cities will be inhabited, the wastes will be built. The build up to the events that we're speaking about in terms of the Lord Jesus Christ returning and coming to Israel is the people, the Jews, building on the West Bank. It is Ezekiel 36, for someone that wants to look this up. Ezekiel 36, verse 8 to 11 is exactly what you're describing. And so we certainly shouldn't be surprised. It's the prophetic word happening in front of us.
No, exactly. And it is. I can't. If you're allowed to throw in a verse, I'm allowed to throw in a verse. And that is the end of Amos. The end of Amos, chapter 9. We have this section coming in at verse 11. In that day, I will raise up the tabernacle of David that has fallen and close up the breaches thereof, and raise up the ruins, and build it as in the days of old. And you carry on down, end of verse 13, the mountains shall drop with sweet wine, and all the hills shall melt, and I will bring again the captivity of my people Israel. They will build the waste cities, inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards, drink the wine thereof, and they shall also make gardens and eat the fruit of them. And I will plant them upon their land, and they shall no more be pulled up out of the land which I have given them, says the Lord thy God. And I know these words here are really important to those living up on the mountains of Israel today. Bibi actually in the past has quoted from verse 14 at the UN. These words mean a lot to the people of Israel today when they read that, especially you can see in verse 15, they shall no more be pulled or plucked up out of their land. These are incredible things. We could go today, Pete. We could take it. We could jump on an aircraft, and you know, within hours, we could be in Israel. You'd be, you know, a couple hours drive up to Mount Gerizim, and you could be sipping wine in the mountains of Israel. And there's many, you know, that is, to me, it's like, this is, we're not just talking about things that could happen. This stuff is real. And we are witnessing things that all the holy prophets have spoken of. We have looked for it. It is so, I love how real and tangible these things are. And when we see Trump making these moves, we've waited for a long time for peace to come, a long time. And we still can't tell you the exact path it's going to take, but that it's happening is, I think, is one of the most significant things. And can we just say the fact that you could have a president that could be incredibly pro-Israel and also come in and say, you know what, Europe, you're a bunch of leeches, I think was one of the words that Vance used. These are things, wow, it moves quick. So super, super appreciate you coming on, Pete. We could carry on, I'm sure, but this has been good. Thank you. God bless. And if the Lord remains away, we'll try and connect again.
Thank you, John.
Take care.